Then he did 20 years in the U.S. Army, and then he lived with Wiley's mother in Sugar Land, Texas, for a six-year spell, from when young Horace Wiley was about 10 years old until he was about 16. And yes, young Horace had called Arnold his uncle. He was an older man than Wiley's mother had been accustomed to, and he was a still silent man with secrets. But at first, he had been a good provider. More details would follow. Landry Vanderbilt and Nagley all plugged the name into their respective systems. Arnold Peter Mason. Landry got nothing of immediate top-line interest. Neither did Vanderbilt. Nagley got a 20-year NCO in the Airborne Infantry. No gold stars, no red flags. Plenty of time in Germany way back when anything could happen. Still alive, according to the Social Security mainframe. 65 years old. Still working, according to the Internal Revenue Service. A modest income, declining year on year. Maybe odd jobs or laboring, slowing up ahead of retirement. The owner of a passport, according to the State Department. No address within the United States. The IRS said his tax returns had been filed from overseas. CIA flagged him as living in Germany. The Berlin Embassy showed him registered as a retired military U.S. citizen resident in a small village near Bremen, an hour away from Hamburg. Reacher said, "Is this a co-production? Is this the two of them together?" Nagley said,
"Maybe that's where the first truck is hidden. At Uncle Arnold's place, not Frankfurt."
"Then why bring a second truck now?"
"Maybe Uncle Arnold let the tires go flat."
"Or maybe they're going to split the load, if it's a co-production. Maybe the $100 million is for Wiley's half only."
"Wait," White said. "Look at this. Uncle Arnold has been in Germany nearly 20 years, since Wiley was 16. That's a hell of a long game."
"And look at this,"
Vanderbilt said. Also listed with Mason on the embassy's register were two non-citizen dependents. Landry said, "A buck gets 10, that's a wife and a kid." Then the phone rang again. The New Orleans FBI, direct from their car, with an important bullet point update. After 6 years of relative happiness, Mrs. Wiley had kicked Arnold Mason out of her house because she accidentally discovered he had a wife in Germany and a son. The boy was handicapped. Mrs. Wiley didn't have much, but she had her standards. Wiley was a practical man, so he cleaned his gun in the dishwasher. Why not? The M9 was built to military specifications. It was designed to withstand continuous saltwater immersion. He used the full pots and pans cycle with the full drying phase. Then he would oil the parts and put the gun back together again, pristine and good as new. He had balled up his spattered clothes with the red file folder and put them in the kitchen trash, a considered decision. First instinct was to take them out and dump them in a can on the street. Not too close, but not too far, either. No one liked to walk a long distance with a suspicious object in his hand. And then, hypothetically, there might be a full-court press. And, hypothetically, the trash cans on the street might get searched. So why let them draw a circle on the map and figure out where you live? Better to leave it right there. The landlord would find it in a month, by which point it wouldn't matter. Wiley picked up the phone and dialed his travel agent, the same girl who had booked his trip to Zurich. She spoke good English. She knew he liked the window seat. She had all the details from his shiny new passport. Muller didn't call. No one was surprised. The working hypothesis had changed from Frankfurt to Bremen, to Uncle Arnold's place. Bishop brought a CIA map and spread it on a table. The embassy showed the top line of the address as Gelb Bauernhof, a name, not a street number. therefore possibly rural, possibly a farm. Reacher pictured barns and garages and outbuildings and piles of worn-out tires. "Hiding places," he said. "We need a car." Bishop said, "You need a plan." The telex machine started up.
"Uncle Arnold's service record," Nagley said.
Reacher said, "The plan is Sergeant Nagley and I will conduct surveillance and gather intelligence."
"Negative," Bishop said.
"CIA and the NSC must be represented. Dr. Sinclair and I will come with you. And the rules of engagement are no engagement at all. Strictly observation only. That's a deal breaker. Legally, this is a complex situation." "Bring a weapon," Reacher said. "Wiley has one. And if it's a farm, they'll have a shotgun."
"I said observation only."
"Bring one anyway."
White said, "You have to get the Iranian out. You're saying 1 hour from now there could be a shooting war. At that exact moment, their deal is dead and the Iranian won't survive it. If you leave him there, you kill him."
Bishop said nothing. The phone rang. Griezmann, who said,
"Do you believe in coincidence?"
Reacher said, "Sometimes."
"A homicide victim was a regular patron of Helmut Klopp's bar. He did his business there. Everyone's lying, of course, but I think he was the one who sold the ID."
"Why?"
"Whispers from other people with other things to hide."
"You have a suspect?"
"Someone preventing or avenging betrayal."
"Was someone just betrayed?"
"No."
"Preventing, then?"
"There are no written records in the victim's apartment. There is, however, a space in an otherwise neat shelf of file folders."
"Mission accomplished," Reacher said. Then he said, "Which could be ironic."
Griezmann said, "How?"
"It's a question of timing. You buy ID and decide to kill the supplier and remove his records to prevent future betrayal. But when do you do it? That's the question. Would a new client take that risk immediately after delivery? Or an old client, at a time of maximum pressure, with his plan finally in motion and maybe already going a little ragged at the edges?"
"I don't know."
"Neither do I. I guess it's about 50-50.
"You think it's Wiley?"
"No, I don't. There could be any number of old clients under stress, and I think Wiley was driving a van at the time. But you're a responsible copper. You'll put him on your list. You'll have to, which means your temporary assistance just started up again."
"I thought you gave up on that."
"On what?"
"Driving Savan. Muller told me you cancelled your request."
"When?"
"I spoke to him an hour ago."
"No. When did I cancel?"
"He said you'd discuss specifics for a while and then suddenly changed your mind."
"Last thing I said was I didn't know exactly where Wiley was going. He said to tell him when I did." "Maybe I misunderstood. Maybe he was waiting for me to call. Maybe he never even started."
"He said you counseled."
"Then he misunderstood, not me."
"I agree. His English is not excellent."
Bishop called across the room.
"The car is here."
Chapter 31 Bishop's CIA car was exactly the same as Orozco's MP car, a big blue Opel sedan, identical in every respect, except it had no bulletproof divider. Bishop drove, and Sinclair sat next to him in the front. Reacher and Nagley sat in the back. Nagley was comfortable, and Reacher was not. Traffic was moving. The sky was gray. Nagley read out loud the telex summary of Arnold Mason's service career. He had been drafted at the age of 20 in 1951, but sent to Germany, not Korea, where he stayed for 20 years, apart from stateside trips for training and maneuvers. He was airborne infantry throughout, trained for the Soviet conflict, and deployed with good but not elite units. He was honorably discharged at the age of 40 in 1971, terminal at staff sergeant. Sinclair said, prior to which he married a German girl and had a kid, who he returned to 20 years ago after just 6 years away. Yet Wiley feels connected. This is a weird relationship. By then the view out the window was agricultural, in a flat, perfect, close-to-the-city kind of a way. The fields were as neat as vegetable gardens, and not much larger. Every road and every street had a name, neatly lettered in Gothic script, black on cream. The passing villages were very small, not much more than crowded and crooked crossroads. There were barns and outbuildings here and there, but smaller and fewer than Reacher expected. It wasn't what he had pictured. It was less private and more orderly. It was clean and tidy, not densely but uniformly populated. Everything was pretty close to everything else. Bishop said, next but one dot on the map and we're there. The next but one dot was a little larger than previous versions, a little denser. They picked up the name of Arnold Mason's Road at a free-for-all five-way in the center of town. It hooked back west of north, away from Bremen in the distance. It was lined left and right with tiny pocket handkerchief farms, no more than small and perfectly neat houses with a few immaculate acres. There were sheds, but no barns. Each farm had a name, all appropriately modest, all no doubt picked out by the owners with a measure of pride. Reacher watched for Gelb Bauernhof and suddenly understood what it meant. It was German for yellow farm. Yellow in Spanish was Amarillo, where Arnold Mason was born, Amarillo, Texas. The guy had named his farm for where he grew up. They found it fifth on the right. They were going slow to read the names, so they got a good look. Not much to see. Maybe 4 acres planted in perfect lines, growing something dark green, possibly cabbages, and a small, neat house, and a small, neat, standalone garage, and a small, neat, standalone shed, set back a little ways, and that was it. The garage would take a Mercedes station wagon. The shed would take a small tractor or a ride-on machine. Neither one would take a stolen furniture truck. Bishop stopped the car a mile down the road. Reacher said, I should go back and knock on the door. Sinclair said, that's a risk. Wiley isn't there. No new van, no old van either. That doesn't prove Uncle Arnold isn't involved somehow. He won't shoot me straight off the bat. He'll play dumb. He'll try to talk his way out of it. I'll let him, if necessary. I agree, if the vans were here, it would be different.
Wiley might arrive while you're in there.
It's a possibility, but unlikely. If it happens, I'm sure Sergeant Nagley will think of something.
We should all go.
Works for me, Reacher said. Bishop said nothing.
Arnold Mason is an American citizen, Sinclair said. You're from the consulate. You're entitled to make contact.
Bishop said, we can't afford to screw this up.
We'll shut it down at the first sign of trouble.
Don't stand close together, Reacher said. Not at first, anyway. Not until we're sure.
Bishop turned the car around on the narrow road. Gelb Bauernhof was a property about 100 yards wide by 200 deep, like a high-end suburban lot in America, but a farm nonetheless, albeit in miniature. There was nothing yellow about it. The sky was gray and the dirt was brown, and the cabbages were army green. Bishop turned in at the driveway, which was dirt, hand-scraped to a consistent camber. The big blue opal hissed over it. The garage was dead ahead. The house was to the left, about 80 yards from the street. Bishop rolled on. There was no reaction.
He stopped where a footpath left the driveway and led to the house, now 20 yards away. Still no reaction. Then a man came out of the house. He left the front door open and took 2 steps and stood on the path and watched. He was about Reacher's own age, maybe 35. He stood tall and straight, fair hair, a shapeless gray sweater, and shapeless gray pants. Nothing on his feet. Reacher said, "I'll go first." He got out of the car slowly and took a step. The guy on the path just watched. Another step. All good. So Reacher kept on going, a step at a time, until he was face to face with the guy, like a salesman calling, or a neighbor in need of advice. Reacher said, "I need to speak with Arnold Peter Mason." The guy didn't answer, didn't react at all, like he hadn't heard. He was looking past Reacher's shoulder into the middle distance. Nothing there but cabbages. Reacher said, "Herr Mason?" The guy looked at him. Blue eyes, empty. Nothing going on back there. The lights were on, but no one was home. The handicapped son. Same age as Wiley. Same generation as the so-called nephew. 35 years old, but still a dependent. Reacher pointed to the house with one hand and made an arm around the shoulder shape with the other and said, "Let's both of us go inside." The guy did nothing for a moment, and then he turned and walked briskly back to the house, his bare feet slapping, and he leaned in the open door and pounded on the wall and shouted out, "Mutti!" Then he stood back and waited. A woman came out. She was small and trim. She had fading blonde hair, cut short. She was maybe 65 years old. A kind face, worn but still handsome. She smiled benignly at Reacher, as if to say she was sure he understood. And then she turned away and thanked her son for a job well done, squeezing his hands, patting his shoulder, cupping his cheek, sending him back inside. Then she stepped up to where Reacher was waiting. She looked at him for a second, and then she said, "Are you from the army?" She spoke in English with an accent, but no hesitation. Reacher said, "How did you know?"
"Arnold said you had come."
"Did he?"
"Although he thought sooner, but still."
"I'm Major Reacher."
"I'm Frau Mason."
"Is Arnold home?"
"Of course."
The others got out of the car and followed Reacher and the woman through the door. The house was small inside, but light and cheerful, with white paint and sprigged wallpapers. The woman led Reacher to a back parlor. She went in. He followed. She crossed the room and bent down and hugged a man in a wheelchair. She kissed him awake. She said,
"Darling, this is Major Reacher from the army."
Arnold Mason, once a teenage ranch hand, then an infantry soldier, then a family man, with 2 different families, now collapsed in a wheelchair, slack on one side, one eye looking, the other eye shut. Reacher said, "Good afternoon, Mr. Mason." The guy didn't answer. He was 65 years old, but he looked 95. He had no strength. No focus. Reacher looked at the woman and said, "Frau Mason, can we talk?" They went back to the hallway. Bishop and Sinclair introduced themselves as government workers. Reacher asked, "What happened to him?" The woman said,
"Don't you know?"
"No, we don't."
"He has a growth in his head."
"Like a tumor?"
"It's a long word. I don't understand. It's crushing his brain. One part after another. Day by day."
"I'm sorry."
"He knew you would be."
Reacher said, "When did it start?"
"A 1.5 years ago.
"Can he talk?"
"A little. He lost movement on one side, so he sounds funny, but he's not upset about it. He was never much of a talker. And now he can't remember anything anyway.
That could be a problem. We're here to ask him questions.
I thought you were here to help him.
Why?
He said if he got sick, someone from the army was sure to come.
Has he been treated by the army before?
No, never.
How bad is his memory?
Patchy, but mostly very bad.
How tired does he get?
He lose track after the first few questions.
Reacher said, "Would you wait outside?"
Has he done something wrong?
The questions are about the period immediately after he mustered out. The 6 years he wasn't here. He might not want you to hear his answers. I'm obliged to consider his privacy. The woman said,
I know all about Mrs. Wiley in Sugarland, Texas. Is that all this is about?
Her son, Reacher said. They went back in the parlor. Mason was still awake and a little brighter. He acknowledged introductions with a vague, one-eyed glance and a movement of his hand. His wife crouched behind his chair and hugged his shoulders as if to reassure him, and Reacher squatted in front of him to get in his line of sight. Reacher said,
Mr. Mason, do you remember Horace Wiley?
Mason closed his working eye and held it shut a moment, and then opened it again. His gaze was far away and watery. The working half of his face moved with exaggerated diction, and he said,
Call me Arnold.
His voice was low and breathy, and half his mouth was frozen, but the words came out clear enough. Reacher said,
Arnold,
tell me about Horace Wiley.
Mason's eye closed again, longer, as if he was consulting an internal source of information. And then his eye opened, and with half a hint of half a smile, he said,
I used to call him Horace. Sounded about the same in Texas, anyway.
When was the last time you heard from him? A pause. Mason said,
I guess I never heard from him. Not since I left.
Did you tell him Davy Crockett stories? A longer pause. Longer, Mason said.
I don't remember any of that.
He said he joined the army because you told him Davy Crockett stories.
Horse joined the army? Hot damn.
What about the stories?
I don't remember.
You sure?
Maybe it was a television show the kid was watching.
Nothing more.
I don't think I would have told stories. Not back then. People said I didn't talk much.
Then his eye closed again, and his chin fell to his chest. His wife propped his head comfortably and held herself up. She said,
He'll sleep now. That was more talking than he is used to.
They filed out to the hallway with the sprig wallpaper. The woman said,
Can you help him?
Bishop said, We'll check with the Veterans Administration. Reacher said, Did he ever tell you the Davy Crockett stories? The woman said,
No, never.
Sinclair said,
How is your son? He's well, thank you. A little slow, by now like a 7-year-old, but placid.
Not boisterous.
We have much to look forward to, except that Arnold blames himself, which is why he went back to Texas after his discharge, all those years ago. He ran away. He couldn't face it all day, every day, because he thought it was his fault. Why? It's genetic. It's him or me. He says it's him. Truth is, it could be both of us, but he insists. But he came back in the end. It all calmed down. He did very well. But he still blames himself, and now he worries what will become of us.
They got back in the car, and they turned around, and they drove away. Reacher said, "Did you believe him?"
"Believe what?" Sinclair said. "He couldn't remember anything."
"Did you believe he couldn't remember anything?"
"Didn't you?"
"I wasn't sure. On the one hand, okay, he's dying from a brain tumor. On the other hand, I didn't like the call me Arnold bullshit. He was buying time. He was an infantryman 20 years, so he can smell MPs a mile away. He wanted to think about his answers."
"Which were, in the end?"
"No, Wiley hadn't contacted him, and no, he didn't remember telling Davy Crockett stories."
"You think he was lying?"
"A person in that condition is hard to read. I think the first part was probably true. He was sad, not defensive. But he paused an awful long time after the Davy Crockett question. Maybe it was the brain tumor, or maybe he was putting two and two together. The passage of time plus Horace Wiley's inborn nature, which he observed at close quarters, plus whatever was in the Davy Crockett stories, plus then, many years later, the sudden appearance of an O4 investigator, equals some kind of an eventual bad outcome, and therefore a need for denial, which our natural sympathy excuses as memory loss, which it might actually be, but we'll never know for sure, because we can't find out. We can't smack the guy around, so to speak." Bishop said, "He can't be actively involved. He's been sick a year and a half." "Agreed," Reacher said. "So it's all about the Davy Crockett stories, which at face value sound like nothing. Just stupid fairy tales for kids. But they were top of Wiley's cryptic list, so clearly they have personal meaning for him." Sinclair said,
"Personal meaning? How?"
Nagley said, "He didn't tell his wife. So they were work-based stories, not home-based. They were army stories, of which there are millions. All kinds of unit legends. Maybe Mason told Wiley his unit's legend, man to man, trying to bond with the kid, like in the movies. The mother's new boyfriend always does that. Maybe Wiley always remembered the stories. Maybe they were powerful enough to make him come check them out, all these years later. What kind of legends are there?"
"We could try a Hail Mary," Nagley said. She was reading Arnold Mason's service record like a sheet of music, moving her finger from measure to measure, head cocked, listening to the tune. She said, "It's a long shot, but if you start way back, a first lieutenant with these guys might have rotated back in as a captain, maybe again as a major or a light colonel. Back then, airborne infantry could build careers. If such a guy did well, he could still be with us. Very senior now, but he'll remember. Everybody remembers their first unit."
"It's 40 years ago."
"If he graduated the point at 22, he's still short of retirement. He'd be a general by now."
"Probably." "How would you find him?"
"I would call a friend in personnel command. Someone would figure it out."
"Do it," Sinclair said, "as soon as we get back."
They drove on. Outside, the sky grew darker, either rain coming or late afternoon, or both. In Jalalabad, dusk was already falling. A messenger was leaving the white mud house. She climbed back into a Toyota pickup truck, same system as before. Drive all night and take the first flight out. She was ready. Still a clean skin, more or less. Not that the Swiss cared. All money was the same to them. She had been coached. She knew the address in Zurich. She knew Zurich would look different than Hamburg. She knew all the numbers, their account number, their passcode, $100 million, 0 cents, Wiley's account number. She had Swiss francs in her pocket for taxis. Pray for success, the fat man had said, but not hers. Her job was easy. He should have said, pray for Wiley's success. She didn't like Wiley, not because of the assault on her modesty, because he was weak and furtive and easily distracted, which worried her. His job wasn't easy. Her success depended on his. If this deal fails, then yes, you will be killed. It wouldn't fail because of her. The Toyota bucked and bounced over washboard roads, heading away from the last of the sunset. Nagley got on the phone in the consulate room and called her friend in personnel command. She explained the Hail Mary. Her friend said the theory sounded simple enough. Look for junior commanders in about 1955 in the airborne divisions in Germany who were still in the army 40 years later. Nagley bet $5 on low single digits. Her friend put 10 on the zero. Because of natural attrition, he said, plus three major upheavals, first Vietnam, and then the Soviet collapse, and then the modern-day volunteer high-tech military machine, all lean and mean, with body armor and women and night-vision goggles. No guy could survive all that. Then another phone rang, and it was picked up by Vanderbilt and handed to Reacher. It was Griezmann, who said, I need to speak with you in private. Reacher said, go ahead. No, face to face, and alone. Where are you? I'm not supposed to tell you that. I can't help you if you won't let me. I'm at the U.S. consulate. Be outside 1 minute from now. Chapter 32. Reacher waited at the curb with his back to the not exactly White House, and he saw Griezmann's Mercedes in traffic 100 yards to his left. He got in when it got there, and Griezmann pulled a U-turn and headed back the way he had come. He was as big as ever, and quiet. He had something on his mind. Reacher said, where are we going? Griezmann said, the railroad station. Why? Because I'm a responsible copper. I added Wiley as a potential suspect, which meant the uniform division got his picture. The feet on the street. They showed it around. A money changer at the railroad station recognized it from a couple of days ago, which makes him your business, not mine. Thank you. However, Griezmann said, that doesn't sound good. You have seen our facilities. Unbelievable results are obtained. We think our victim was hit 7 times on the top of the head, almost a frenzy, all in the same place, so the wound is mush. Except 2 of the 7 blows erred slightly, one to the left, one to the right, and by combining opposite halves of those 2 crisp impressions, we can see the overall shape of the implement used as the bludgeon. Good work. We have an extensive database of such things for reference and comparison. I'm sure you do. It was the butt of a Beretta M9 pistol, Reacher said. I see. Which is the U.S. Army's standard issue, sidearm? Wasn't me. Was it Wiley? I don't know. Just one more thing, Griezmann said. But it had to wait, because the light turned green and the Mercedes rolled into the square in front of the station. The gray sky made it dark early. The streetlights were on. People streamed in and out, fast and purposeful, flowing around others, standing dazed and mute. There was a lit-up booth halfway back. Foreign currency. One guy. Griezmann parked, and they walked the rest of the way. The guy in the booth was small and dark. He spoke fast, even in English. Reacher showed him the sketch, and he said,
"Yeah, 2 days ago, in the evening, Deutschmarks and dollars into Argentinian pesos."
"How much?"
"About 400 bucks.
Was he nervous or excited?
He was gazing all around like he was thinking.
About what?
I have no idea, man.
Reacher stepped back and gazed all around. It was getting darker by the minute. He saw streams of people, and behind them the railroad station, all lit up, as big and fancy as a museum or a cathedral. He saw city lights and the grind of traffic. Griezmann said,
"Now get back in the car."
They drove 2 more blocks in the traffic, and then they turned off and parked in a quiet street. They sat side by side in the front of the car, staring ahead through the windshield. Griezmann seemed to prefer it that way. Alone, but not exactly face to face, he said,
"I told you there was a space in an otherwise neat shelf of file folders."
"You found the missing item?"
"No. We found something else. The file folders were made of stiff board covered in vinyl, all different colors, with 4 rings inside. They line up like books.
Are you familiar with this product?"
"Ours have 3 rings inside." "Suppose there were 10 such items neatly lined up on a high shelf, numbered from 1 to 10. Suppose I asked you to take down number 6. How would you do it?"
"I'm tempted to say it ain't rocket science, except it probably is. I've seen your facilities."
"They ran an experiment. They simulated the scene and randomly selected 34 subjects. Basically, anyone who passed their office door. Every single one pulled the file exactly the same way. 100%.
"Now,
you reach up and touch the part of your index finger to the spine of your chosen file, in our case number 6, as if you've traced it and now you're claiming it, very discreetly. It's yours. The ownership issue is psychologically settled, but it's lined up perfectly. There's nothing to grip, but you can't move your index finger. Subconsciously, you can't give up your claim. So you put the edge of your thumb on number 5 and the part of your middle finger on number 7, and you ease them back, very respectfully, because it's a neat shelf, and then you jump your thumb and your middle finger inward to pincer the sliver of spine you've just exposed, and you pull the pile out with your index finger exactly where it always was, on the spine, ready to balance the load as it comes down toward you."
"Good work," Reacher said again.
"Reverse the numbers for left-handed people, of course."
"But I'm guessing he wasn't left-handed."
"We have a perfect print from the spine of the adjacent file. The pad of his right-hand middle finger pressed gently against the vinyl."
"Is it in his system?"
"An exact match."
"That's good."
"With the print we took from the dead girl's sports car, from the chrome lever, the unknown suspect."
"It's the same guy, Reacher. The prints are identical. Same finger, same angle, same cautious pressure. It's uncanny."
Reacher said nothing.
"First a woman, and then a man was savagely murdered," Griezmann said. "You know who did it. Help me find Wiley, and I'll tell you."
"But I also be helping myself. Let's ask him when we find him. But you could tell me now.
Tell who now? The simple detective? Or the obedient bureaucrat who will pass it all on to his intelligence service in Berlin about 10 minutes from now, whereupon I would go to jail about 10 minutes after that?
Do you not tell your superiors what they should know?
I tell them as little as possible. Short words, no map and no diagrams.
You'll go to jail anyway. In Germany, it is illegal to withhold this kind of information.
You going to arrest me?
I could make you a material witness. You would be obliged to answer. Refusal would be deemed contempt of the judicial system.
I'm sure there's a joke in there somewhere.
This is a serious business.
There's a case to be made. Ours is more serious. I'm sure my president would be happy to explain it to your chancellor, but we don't need to go that route. Help me find Wiley, and then we'll figure out this other thing together.
Did he do it?
Forget the print. A lawyer wouldn't like it anyway. It could have been left months ago. You need to come at it another way. The Beretta was a good catch. They're for sale in your victim's favorite bar. Did you know that? Who could have bought one there?
Wiley, Griezmann said. He bought his ID there.
Good theory. Promising. Doesn't prove anything yet, but clearly the next step would be to find him and talk to him.
Where is he?
I don't know. At that moment, Wiley was 100 yards away, crossing the street at a walk light 2 blocks east of the train station. He was dressed in black pants and a black hooded sweatshirt. He was carrying a small black duffel. It was heavy. Its load shifted and clanked as he walked. At first he followed a familiar route from the bus stop toward the bar with the varnished wood front. But halfway there he turned off and stepped into a vehicle entrance and walked past 2 head-high trash receptacles. He opened a stairwell door marked exit only, and he walked up a flight to the hotel parking garage, where he had met the hooker. He remembered the way she turned around and beckoned him to her car, like she couldn't wait. He remembered every detail. No cameras. He walked to the far corner of the floor, smelling cold gasoline, cold diesel, cold rubber, and cold cement dust. He picked out a silver BMW, 6-cylinder, gasoline, an older model. It had the look of a car parked a long time. The windshield was dull. The paint was filmed with neglect. He squatted in front of its radiator grill. He took a crosshead screwdriver from his duffel. He unfastened the front license plate and stored it in his bag. He moved around and squatted behind the trunk. He unscrewed the rear plate and put it in his bag. He took out a single-burner camp stove, bought new for the occasion. It was about 8 inches square, made of pressed steel, with a rubber tube and a knurled brass valve. He took out a head-sized canister of propane. Bright blue. Cheap. Easy and convenient. He attached the valve. He turned the knob and heard a hiss of gas. He shut it off. He lay down on the cold concrete and slid the burner 2 feet under the rear of the car. He took 6 wooden blocks from his bag. Children's toys from Sweden, he thought. Each one was about 6 inches long and 1 inch square. Each one was lacquered a different bright color. He built them into a tower on top of the burner, where a coffee pot or a tea kettle would go. He put 2 one way, then 2 the other, and finally the 3rd layer, the same way as the first, like a little campfire. He took out a silver foil dish, the size and shape of a roast chicken. He balanced it on the tower of wooden blocks. He took out a box of 9mm Parabellum ammunition, 100 rounds, one of 2 bought with the M9 from the chuckleheads in the bar. He threaded his hand through the space under the BMW suspension and laid the box gently in the silver foil dish. Finished. Good to go. The propane, the tube, the burner, the short stack of wood, the roasting dish, the handgun rounds, the BMW's gas tank, directly above. He checked his position and rehearsed the backward scoot. Then he took out a Zippo lighter. He checked the knurled brass knob. He turned on the burner. He heard the hiss of gas. He flicked the lighter and brought the flame to the burner's rose. The gas caught with a thump. He dialed it back to a lower setting. A click below medium, like a fast simmer. Then he slid out backward and stood up and grabbed his bag and hustled. A mile away, Dremler came out of his fourth-floor office and spent 20 seconds in the elevator, which was 33 pairs of Brazilian shoes, and then Muller fell in step with him on the sidewalk and said, "You've heard, I expect." "About Wolfgang Schlupp," Dremler said. "I've heard about nothing else. The police have been all over that bar. My members there are very upset. My phone has been ringing off the hook." "Was it Wiley?" "I thought he was out of town."
"So did everybody. They were all focused outward. No one even looked the other way. So I did, just to be sure. 2 cameras on traffic lights. For flow, supposedly, but recorded all the same. And there he is, driving the other way, towards St. Georg. He never left town. He's in town right now."
"Where?"
"It's a large white vehicle. Every traffic cop on the force is looking for it."
Dremler walked a couple of steps in silence. Then he said, "Herr Muller, in your professional opinion concerning Wolfgang Schlupp, how serious will the investigation be?"
"Extremely. His head was bashed in."
"They'll make a list of people he spoke to today."
"I'll be on it."
"Naturally. Chief of Detectives Griezmann likes lists. He likes paperwork in general."
"I can't afford to be implicated. It would be politically inconvenient."
"Just make up a story. You are a businessman. He's a businessman. You are talking about the stock market. It's not like he can contradict you."
"Will that be enough?"
"It was just a weird coincidence. Maybe you saw him at a business dinner. He was a nodding acquaintance. You were merely saying hello, a professional courtesy. You hardly knew the fellow."
Griezmann drove Reacher back to the consulate and let him out on the same curb he had got in from before. Then Griezmann drove away and Reacher went inside, where he discovered Nately had won her $5 bet. She had a sheet of telex paper to prove it. Low single digits, she had predicted, and she had scored with the lowest digit of all. In 1955, the United States Army was considerably north of 1 million strong. Part of that strength was a young first lieutenant by the name of Wilson T. Helmsworth. He was a recent graduate of West Point and several specialist schools. He was hunting one airborne command after another. He was technically Arnold Mason's superior officer several different times. It was even theoretically possible the two had met, in some kind of a formal setting, maybe a parade, not cracking beers. Then later, Helmsworth moved onward and upward, and along the way he qualified in anything and everything related to a parachute. At one time or another, he held all the records, freefall included. He wrote book after book about paratrooper tactics. Then he survived a long jungle war where the canopy was thick and the air was misty and the infantry didn't give a damn about paratrooper tactics. and he came out of it promoted. He got on board early with special forces theory, and about 20-odd generations later, he was still there in the thick of it, now in overall command of training at Fort Benning, Georgia, where the tough stuff was invented. Major General Wilson T. Helmsworth, the only Cold War airborne junior commander still wearing the green suit. From the Brown Boot Army to the Black Boot Army to the New Balance Army. Tenacious. 1,000,000 to 1. Literally. Negley said, "As of this moment, he's located at Benning." Sinclair said, "He needs 30 minutes to set up a call. He's a busy man." "We can't do this by phone," Reacher said. "It has to be done face to face. He's been in the Army 40 years. He knows how to bullshit. We need to be in the same room. We need to see his body language."
We can't all fly back. Not now. None of us should fly back."
"None of us is going to. Helmsworth is going to come to us. If he's at Benning, he can get to Atlanta for the night flight. He could be here in the morning. I think the Joint Chiefs should order him to report to the Hamburg consulate immediately."
"Because of someone else's cryptic, half-remembered childhood legend?"
"Ratcliffe said we get what we need."
"Helmsworth's a 2-star general."
"Which means he'll run away from anything soft or speculative at 100 miles an hour, and anything even remotely controversial at 200 miles an hour. Won't work on the phone. He needs to see the face of the NSC, and we need to see his."
"It's a big deal for a Hail Mary."
"It's a foreign country. Possibly there's a foreign enemy here. I'll give him another medal. Theoretically, he could get a Silver Star."
"For flying in?"
"He's a 2-star general. They get medals like frequent flyer miles."
"Are you sure we need him?"
"No stone unturned."
Sinclair made the call. Then outside the window there was a faint, distant sound, a dull and hollow pop, pop, and a blunted hiss of air, and then more. Pop, pop, pop. The back part of Reacher's brain said handgun, probably 9mm rounds, urban setting, probably 0.5 mile distant. He stepped to the window and heaved it open. He heard sirens in the distance, then more gunfire, 4 rounds, then 5, very faint but louder because of the open window, and then more sirens, 2 different tones, probably ambulances and cop cars, and then a furious volley of gunfire, impossibly fast, like a continuous explosion, like 100 machine guns firing all at once, like the best fireworks show the town park ever had. And then there was the muted, concussive thump of a fuel explosion, and 2 more handgun rounds, and then nothing but sirens, the scream of cop cars, the yelp of ambulances, the deafening bass bark of fire trucks, all blending in a howl that sounded more like sorrow than help. Reacher looked out at the street and saw cops racing past, all in the same direction, most in cars, some on motorcycles, one on foot, half running. He saw 2 ambulances and a fire truck. The whole place was flashing red and blue. Sinclair said,
"What was it?"
Negley said, "It sounded like a house fire where someone left a box of ammunition on the kitchen counter. Then the propane tank went up. Except we should have heard the sirens earlier. But maybe it was a stone building. Maybe the fire was concealed from exterior view. Therefore, the alarm was sounded late."
"Deliberate?"
"Maybe, maybe not. Either way sounds the same."
"Related?"
"Can't say," White said. "This is a big city. There's a lot going on."
There was a 2nd fuel explosion, faint and far away, but unmistakable. A thump, a silent vacuum, the suck of air, and the sensation of blooming heat, however impossible. Reacher watched the street. Every cop in town was heading in the same direction.
Chapter 33. Wiley took the padlock off the hasp in the center of the door, and then off the top bolt and the bottom, and he dragged the door open and he ducked inside. He was calm. He had simple mechanical tasks ahead of him. First up were the plates. He took off the rentals, fresh new issue, and he put on the old BMW's number in their place. Then he took out his cans of spray paint, bought at the hardware store, lurid greens and yellows and orange and red and silver. He sprayed fat initials on the side of the van, his own, just for the hell of it, but reversed, WH, all swelled up like balloons, like you saw on the subway cars. He shaded the letters with silver and sprayed random swirls in the background and added a fat S and a fat L, like a tag for a second artist, except it wasn't. It was Sugarland, right there on the truck. Because why the hell not? It was where he was from, and it was where he was going. Then he sprayed a mist of gray over everything else to calm it down, to give it age. He stood back. He was lightheaded from the aerosol fumes, but he was satisfied. It was no longer a new white truck. It was a piece of urban junk. It was no longer worthy of a passing glance. Not that anyone would be passing. Everyone was at the hotel. There would be crowds of law enforcement and all kinds of perimeters, firefighters and SWAT teams in the center because of the handgun rounds and the gasoline fires, then all kinds of security and rubberneckers and glory hunters. I was there, man. The bullets were zipping right over my head. He opened the double doors all the way, and then he climbed in and started up the rental. He reversed it out and maneuvered it around, sawing it back and forth until it was lined up perfectly. He watched his mirrors and backed it up slowly, slowly, until its rear bumper kissed the old truck's rear bumper. He put on the parking brake and shut down the motor. He climbed through from the cab to the load space. He rolled up the rear door from the inside. The old truck's rear door was right there, an inch away. He unlocked it and rolled it up from the outside. A wooden crate. It was 6 feet high and 6 feet wide and 12 feet long. It was solidly made from tight-grained softwood, straight and true, once pale, now aged, to a tobacco amber. It was a prototype of a standardized container system the Pentagon experimented with in the 1950s. A survivor. A piece of history. It was stenciled here and there with faded whitewash numbers. It weighed more than 600 pounds. No way to move it without a forklift truck, one of which he no longer had. He took out a regular slot screwdriver from his bag. Old-fashioned, like the crate. It had screws the size of buttons. They were set on 6-inch centers all around the perimeter of the end panel, 44 in total, probably the result of a study by a research and development corporation. Some guy in a suit got a fat check for saying more was better, which made everyone happy. The Pentagon's ass was covered. The screw supplier was making out like a bandit, probably charged $1 each. Military spec. Wiley got to work. The phone rang in the consulate room. Griezmann, who said, "Something is happening in the hotel parking garage where the hooker vanished. There were gunshots and then a car blew up, then two more. The fire is contained because there are sprinklers and foam on the ceiling, but we can't get close, not until we're sure about the gun." Reacher said, "You think the guy is still in there?" "Don't you?" We didn't like the sound. It could have been ammo cooking off, some kind of a delayed mechanism. You need to consider someone set it up on a timer, in which case he's long gone. He's where you're not.
Who?
Horace Wiley, maybe. He's keeping to a busy schedule right now. He might be in need of a decoy.
You should put half your men back on the street.
You think he's back in town?
I'm beginning to think he never left. He could be moving.